righteousness of God is that by which the righteous live by a gift of God, namely by faith. Here I felt that I was altogether born again, and had entered paradise itself through open gates. There a totally other face of the entire scripture showed itself to me. As he observes in that last sentence, when he grasped that salvation was by grace, rather than through any effort of his own, it made him rethink his whole understanding of scripture, including his view of the meaning of work. Luther found two implications in particular. First, if religious works were crucial to achieving a good standing with God, then there would always be a fundamental difference between those in church ministry and everyone else. But if religious work did absolutely nothing to earn favor with God, it could no longer be seen as superior to other forms of labor. The gospel of salvation through sheer grace holds a second implication for work. While ancient monks may have sought salvation through religious works, many modern people seek a kind of salvation, self-esteem and self-worth, from career success. This leads us to seek only high-paying, high-status jobs, and to worship them in perverse ways. But the gospel frees us from the relentless pressure of having to prove ourselves and secure our identity through work, for we are already proven and secure. It also frees us from a condescending attitude toward less sophisticated labor and from envy over more exalted work. All work now becomes a way to love the God who saved us freely, and by extension, a way to love our neighbor. So Luther could write about believers, "Even their seemingly secular works are a worship of God, and an obedience well-pleasing to God." He also said, "Why should I not therefore freely, joyfully, with all my heart, and with an eager will, give myself as a Christ to my neighbor, just as Christ offered himself to me, since through faith I have an abundance of all good things in Christ." Since we already have in Christ the things other people work for, salvation, self-worth, a good conscience, and peace, now we may work simply to love God and our neighbors. It is a sacrifice of joy, a limitation that offers freedom. This means, ironically, that Christians who understand biblical doctrine ought to be the ones who appreciate the work of non-Christians the most. We know we are saved by grace alone, and therefore we are not better fathers or mothers, better artists or business persons, than those who do not believe as we do. Our gospel-trained eyes can see the world ablaze with the glory of God's work to the people he has created and called, in everything from the simplest actions, such as milking a cow, to the most brilliant artistic or historic achievements. Work as an act of love. This revolutionary way of looking at work gives all work a common and exalted purpose, to honor God by loving your neighbors and serving them through your work. Author Dorothy Sayers recounts how many British men and women stumbled upon something like this understanding of work during the dark days of World War II. "The habit of thinking about work as something one does to make money is so ingrained in us that we can scarcely imagine what a revolutionary change it would be to think about it instead in terms of work done itself. I believe there is a Christian doctrine of work very closely related to the doctrines of the creative energy of God and the divine image in man. The essential modern heresy being that work is not the expression of man's creative energy in the service of society, but only something one does in order to obtain money and leisure." She goes on to explain what happens as a result. "Doctors practice medicine not primarily to relieve suffering, but to make a living. The cure of the patient is something that happens on the way. Lawyers accept briefs not because they have a passion for justice, but because the law is the profession which enables them to live. But during the war, many people were drawn into the army and found a new, surprising sense of fulfillment in their work. The reason why men often find themselves happy and satisfied in the army is that for the first time in their lives, they found themselves doing something not for the pay, which is miserable, but for the sake of getting the thing done. Sayers was talking about wartime Britain, in which every person knew that their work was contributing to the very survival of their nation. But author Lester de Coster does an excellent job of showing how indispensable work is for human life in all times and places. Work is the form in which we make ourselves useful to others, in which others make themselves useful to us. We plant with our work. God gives the increase to unify the human race. Look at the chair you are lounging in. Could you have made it yourself? How would you get, say, the wood? Go and fell a tree? But only after first making the tools for that, and putting together some kind of vehicle to haul the wood, and constructing a mill to do the lumber, and roads to drive on from place to place? In short, a lifetime or two to make one chair. If we worked not 40 but 140 hours per week, we couldn't make ourselves from scratch even a fraction of all the goods and services that we call our own. Our paycheck turns out to buy us the use of far more than we could possibly make for ourselves in the time it takes us to earn the check. Work yields far more in return upon our efforts than our particular jobs put in. Imagine that everyone quits working right now. What happens? Civilized life quickly melts away. Food vanishes from the shelves. Gas dries up at the pumps. Streets are no longer patrolled, and fires burn themselves out. Communication and transportation services end. Utilities go dead. Those who survive at all are soon huddled around campfires, sleeping in caves, clothed in raw animal hides. The difference between a wilderness and culture is simply work. There may be no better way to love your neighbor, whether you are writing parking tickets, software, or books, than to simply do your work. But only skillful, competent work will do. Work as a ministry of competence. One of the main ways that you love others in your work is through the ministry of competence. If God's purpose for your job is that you serve the human community, then the way to serve God best is to do the job as well as it can be done. Dorothy Sayers writes, "The church's approach to an intelligent carpenter is usually confined to exhorting him not to be drunk and disorderly in his leisure hours and to come to church on Sundays. What the church should be telling him is this, that the very first demand that his religion makes upon him is that he should make good tables." Let me give a dramatic example of this. On February 24, 1989, United Airlines Flight 811 took off from Honolulu on its way to New Zealand. The 747 had climbed to 22,000 feet when the forward cargo door of the jet blew open, tearing a huge hole in the side of the plane. 9 passengers were immediately sucked out of the plane to their deaths. The 2 right engines were damaged by flying debris and taken out of commission. The plane was 100 miles from land. The captain, David Cronin, brought all of his wisdom and 38 years of piloting experience to bear. To compensate for the lack of thrust from the 2 right engines, he struggled to hold the control column steady with his hands while using his feet to put pressure on the control floor rudder to stabilize the plane. His stickiest problem, however, was deciding how fast to fly. He slowed the plane as close to the stall speed as possible to keep the air rushing over the plane from further widening the hole in the fuselage. Because the hole had changed the aerodynamics of the huge craft, the usual data regarding stall speed was no longer relevant. The pilot, knowing this, had to use his best judgment. Furthermore, since the plane had just taken on 300,000 pounds of fuel for the long flight, it was too heavy to land without collapsing the landing gear. Then he encountered a new problem. The wing flaps used to slow down the plane were not working properly. He would have to land the plane at 195 miles per hour, compared to the normal speed of 170 miles per hour. The jet weighed 610,000 pounds, well above Boeing's recommended maximum stress load of 564,000 pounds. Nevertheless, Captain Cronin made one of the smoothest landings the rest of the crew could remember, amid the cheers of the passengers. Airline experts called the landing miraculous. A few days after the harrowing experience, an interviewer asked Captain Cronin about his first thoughts following the loss of the cargo door. He said, "I said a prayer for my passengers momentarily, and then got back to business." Lutheran leader and businessman William Diehl recounts this inspiring story to make an important point. He writes, "If lay people cannot find any spiritual meaning in their work, they are condemned to living a certain dual life, not connecting what they do on Sunday morning with what they do the rest of the week. They need to discover that the very actions of daily life are spiritual and enable people to touch God in the world, not away from it. Such a spirituality will say, 'Your work is your prayer.'" So, how do we connect what we do on Sunday morning with what we do during the rest of the week? How can we touch God in the world through our work? Diehl answers that the very first way to be sure you are serving God in your work is to be competent. When United Airlines Flight 811 got into trouble, the greatest gift Captain Cronin had for his passengers was his experience and good judgment. In those moments of peril, it mattered not to the passengers how Captain Cronin related to his co-workers or how he communicated his faith to others. The critical issue was this: was he competent enough as a pilot to bring that badly damaged plane in safely? Through our work, we can touch God in a variety of ways, but if the call of the Christian is to participate in God's ongoing creative process, the bedrock of our ministry has to be competency. We must use our talents in as competent a manner as possible. Competency is a basic value. It is not a means to some other end, such as wealth or position, although such results may occur. The applications of this dictum, that competent work is a form of love, are many. Those who grasp this understanding of work will still desire to succeed, but will not be nearly as driven to overwork or made as despondent by poor results. If it is true, then if you have to choose between work that benefits more people and work that pays you more, you should seriously consider the job that pays less and helps more, particularly if you can be great at it. It means that all jobs, not merely so-called helping professions, are fundamentally ways of loving your neighbor. Christians do not have to do direct ministry or non-profit charitable work in order to love others through their jobs. In particular, this principle is one of the main ways for us to find satisfaction in our work, even if our jobs are not, by the world's standards, exciting, high-paying, and desirable. Even though, as Luther argues, all work is objectively valuable to others, it will not be subjectively fulfilling unless you consciously see and understand your work as a calling to love your neighbor. John Calvin wrote that no task will be seen as so sordid and base, provided you obey your calling in it, that it will not shine and be reckoned very precious in God's sight. Notice that Calvin speaks of obeying your calling in it, that is, consciously seeing your job as God's calling and offering the work to Him. When you do that, you can be sure that the splendor of God radiates through any task, whether it is as commonplace as tilling a garden, or as rarefied as working on the global trading floor of a bank. As Eric Liddell's missionary father exhorts him in Chariots of Fire, "You can praise the Lord by peeling a spud, if you peel it to perfection." Your daily work is ultimately an act of worship to the God who called and equipped you to do it, no matter what kind of work it is. In the liner notes to his masterpiece, A Love Supreme, John Coltrane says it beautifully. "This album is a humble offering to Him, an attempt to say, 'Thank you, God,' through our work, even as we do in our hearts and with our tongues. May He help and strengthen all men in every good endeavor. Part 2. Our Problems with Work. Chapter 5. Work Becomes Fruitless. To the woman he said, "I will make your pains in childbearing very severe. With painful labor you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you." To Adam he said, "Because you listened to your wife and ate fruit from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return." Genesis chapter 3, verses 16 through 19. Paradise Lost. We have surveyed the rich biblical view of God's perfect design for work. But that is not how we experience it. Everyone knows that this is a broken, troubled world, shot through with sickness and death, injustice and selfishness, natural disasters and chaos. Since the beginning of time, there has been a wide variety of explanations for why this is so, and what to do about it. At the heart of the Bible's account is the concept of sin, man's rebellion against God, and our resulting alienation from Him. The fall of Adam and Eve, and therefore the rest of the human race, into sin, has been disastrous. It has unraveled the fabric of our entire world, and in no area as profoundly as our work. The story presented in the Bible is that while God blessed work to be a glorious use of our gifts and His resources to prosper the world, it is now also cursed because of mankind's fall. Work exists now in a world sustained by God, but disordered by sin. Only if we have some understanding of how sin distorts work can we hope to counteract its effects and salvage some of the satisfaction God planned for our work. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 17, God put Adam and Eve into a garden paradise and told them that if they disobeyed Him and ate of a particular tree, they would surely die. What was so special about that one tree? The answer is probably nothing, per se. That is, there was likely nothing magical or unusual about the tree or the fruit itself. The tree was a test. God was saying, "I want you to do something for me, not because you understand why, not because you can see whether it would benefit you or disadvantage you. I want you to obey me simply because of who I am, simply because you love me and trust me more than anything." This command, in fact, contained the essence of all the biblical commandments that would be laid out to the nation of Israel many generations later. It was an opportunity for the human race to voluntarily make our relationship with God the primary value of our lives and to obey His word simply because it was His due. When Adam and Eve disobeyed this command, they did become like God, as the serpent who deceived them into disobedience said they would. That is, they put themselves in God's place. They took upon themselves the right to decide how they should live and what was right and wrong for them to do. For them to become like God in this way was catastrophic. As a sailboat is designed for the water, such that if it runs aground, it is damaged and useless, we human beings run aground when we choose to be our own source of authority. We were designed to know, serve, and love God supremely. And when we are faithful to that design, we flourish. But when we instead chose to live for ourselves, everything began to work backward. After this turning point, the human race began to live against the grain of the universe, against the grain of our own making and purpose. As Paul says in Romans chapter 8, the entire world is now subject to decay. The poet W.B. Yeats put it this way, Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. God had warned Adam and Eve that if they ate of the tree, they would die. Most readers assume that God is speaking of immediate physical death. So it is surprising to us when Adam and Eve eat of the tree, and they do not slump lifeless to the ground. But that would happen in due course, for eventual physical shutdown is one aspect of the comprehensive death and decay that now comes to every aspect of human life. Nothing works now as it should. Sin leads to the disintegration of every area of life. Spiritual, physical, social, cultural, psychological, temporal, eternal. This is important to remember, for many Christians tend to divide the world into worldly and sacred spaces and activities, as if sin affects only things out in the world. Yet absolutely every part of human life, soul and body, private and public, praying and laboring, is affected by sin. Yeats said that things fall apart, and because of sin they do. Things fall apart. A continued look at Genesis chapter 3 shows that as soon as Adam and Eve sinned against God, they experienced internal shame, guilt, and brokenness. They suffered the natural consequences of working against their design. They realized they were naked, verse 7. This is the opposite of verse 25 in chapter 2, where we read that Adam and Eve had been, as we often put it today, naked and unashamed. Old Testament scholar David Atkinson writes, "Shame is that sense of unease with yourself at the heart of your being. We know there is something wrong with us, but we can't admit it or identify it. There is a deep restlessness, which can take various forms. Guilt, and striving to prove ourselves. Rebellion, and the need to assert our independence. Compliance, and the need to please others. Something is wrong, and we may know the effects, but we fall short of understanding the true causes." Contemporary Western culture tries to account for this restlessness without recourse to the biblical doctrine of sin. Psychologists help us understand the part our early childhoods have played in creating unnecessary shame or a sense of being unloved. Entertainment distracts us from our discomfort, and doing good helps bolster our identity as a good person. But the Bible locates the root issue as our separation from God. Another manifestation of this deep unease includes a mistrust and fear of others. The awareness of a need for clothing in the biblical account, verse 7, "they made coverings for themselves," is much more than a new reticence about sex. There was a desire to retreat from what could be called an unself-protective mutuality. Adam and Eve each became desperate to control what the other knew, to hide and create facades, to block the other's gaze. This mistrust and fear quickly led to friction and anger, as it now does in all relationships. In his fascinating interview of Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 3, verses 10 through 13, God asks them, "What has happened?" Adam completely avoids the real truth, that he has eaten of the tree, and only complains of his inner unhappiness and shame. God's second question is so direct that Adam cannot avoid naming what he has done, but he immediately deflects the responsibility away from himself to Eve. In turn, Eve deflects to the serpent. Their hostility and anger are directed not only toward other creatures, but toward God as well. Adam blames God for his problems. "The woman you put here with me, she gave me, and I ate." Verse 12. One commentator on Genesis writes, "In Genesis chapter 3, verse 8, there is an inadequate awareness of the seriousness of sin. Moral perceptions are clouded, and the self-centered view of values is well beneath the God-centered view. The blindness of sin is beginning to take effect. From the moment of the fall, humankind has suffered from moral schizophrenia, neither able to deny sinfulness, nor to acknowledge it for what it is. Genesis chapter 3 shows how sin warps every part of our nature, every aspect of human living. It begins by distorting the areas of sex, gender, love, and marriage. God, chillingly, explains the impact of sin on the relationship between husbands and wives. Scholars debate the exact meaning of God's statement that now, because of sin, your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. Verse 16. But all agree it means at least that misunderstanding, frustration, deep conflict, and unhappiness are now the norm in relationships between men and women. The very fabric of the physical world now began to unravel. And the results are disease, old age, natural disaster, and death itself. See Genesis chapter 3, verses 17 through 19. Philosopher Al Walters explains it like this. The Bible teaches plainly that Adam and Eve's fall into sin was not just an isolated act of disobedience, but an event of catastrophic significance for creation as a whole. The effects of sin touch all of creation. No created thing is in principle untouched by the corrosive effects of the fall. Whether we look at societal structures such as the state or family, or cultural pursuits such as art or technology, or bodily functions such as sexuality or eating or anything at all within the wide scope of creation, we discover that the good handiwork of God has been drawn into the sphere of mutiny against God. The whole creation, Paul writes, has been groaning, is subject to bondage and decay. Genesis chapter 3 is an ancient text, filled with rich theology and narrative form. But it could not be more relevant and practical to life today. It goes for the jugular, as if to say, do you find the two great tasks in life, work and love, to be excruciatingly hard? This explains why. God ties the pain of love and marriage and the pain of work very closely together in these verses. Both childbearing and farming are now called painful labor. Theologian W. R. Forrester writes, in language after language, the same word is used for toil and childbearing, e.g., labor and travail. So companies assemble teams to work furiously for months or years to give birth to new products or ventures, which may die a quick death in the marketplace. Star football players often suffer the effects of injuries throughout their lives. Brilliant entrepreneurs like Steve Jobs get thrown out of companies when times get tough. Few get invited back like Jobs was. The weeds, or the computer viruses, or the corruption scandals come back with a vengeance. Research into the properties of the atom becomes the basis for the atomic bomb. In other words, work, even when it bears fruit, is always painful, often miscarries, and sometimes kills us. Thorns and thistles. Sin affects not only personal and private life, but also public and social life, and in particular work. As we have seen in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, God made us for work, yet now we learn that work becomes, under sin, painful toil, see verse 17. Work is not itself a curse, but it now lies with all other aspects of human life under the curse of sin. Thorns and thistles will come up as we seek to grow food. Verse 18. When we remember that gardening is representative of all kinds of human labor and culture building, this is a statement that all work and human effort will be marked by frustration and a lack of fulfillment. Part of the curse of work in a fallen world is its frequent fruitlessness. What do we mean when we say work is fruitless? We mean that in all our work, we will be able to envision far more than we can accomplish, both because of a lack of ability and because of resistance in the environment around us. The experience of work will include pain, conflict, envy, and fatigue, and not all our goals will be met. For example, you may have an aspiration to do a certain kind of work and perform at a certain level of skill and quality, but you may never even get the opportunity to do the work you want, or if you do, you may not be able to do it as well as it needs to be done. Your conflicts with others in the work environment will sap your confidence and undermine your productivity. But even during times when you are satisfied with the quality of your work, you may be bitterly disappointed with the results. You may find that circumstances conspire to neutralize any real impact from your project. You may have mastered the skills of farming, but famine or flood or war come in and destroy your harvest. You may have become an accomplished singer, but you are not able to generate an income from your talent because you are skillful in music, but not in self-promotion, or because ruthless rivals find ways of blackballing you, and so you have to give up your musical career. You may hope to make a real contribution to your organization or to work with distinction as an expert in your field. You may aspire to change the world, make a major improvement in human society, or have a lasting impact on the culture. Most people achieve very few of these goals in their lifetimes, and even those who seem from a distance to lead charmed work lives will sense that their true aspirations are thwarted as often as they are reached. And for all of us, more often than we would like to admit, we are the ones doing the thwarting. Imagine you are on a hospital administration team with a vision for making epical advances in patient care. You make a series of significant changes to how your medical staff sees and treats patients. Initial responses by patients are highly positive, and so are some key metrics on incidence of patient harm, such as blood infections, surgical site infections, and medication errors. But the various new accountability measures, such as department report cards and safety dashboards, have many of your medical staff up in arms. They complain that the pressure is too great, the measurements are unfair, and an honest, inadvertent mistake can now ruin a career. You try to reason with many of the staff, but you begin to get defensive. In one staff meeting, you lose your cool and say that many staff persons are failing to put the interests of the patients first. There may be some truth in your statement, but it backfires badly. Some are furious with your insinuation. Several of your most respected people leave, and morale takes a sharp dip. What has happened? Many things. You can look back and see places where you could have been more careful and sensitive to the fears of medical staff. You could have not taken the criticism so personally that you spoke unwisely in some public meetings. So you, and your sin, were part of the problem. You, to put it starkly, were a thorn. The medical staff, in many cases, was simply being stubborn and concerned more about possible blots on their personal records than about the safety of patients. Underneath everything else, there is the tragic and seemingly unfair fact of life that in medical facilities, small and virtually unavoidable human errors can ruin or end lives. The thorns and thistles in this situation stem from alienation from others that has its root in the loss of our relationship with God. So even on our best days, each of us is working within a system that feels stacked against us. I often feel that I have the best job in the world, for me. I am doing what I love to do. We have seen more fruitfulness in our church's ministry than I ever expected to see in a lifetime. But I experience plenty of thorns and thistles. One season I learned I had thyroid cancer, and all but the most basic parts of my work were put on hold. My wife has had medical emergencies that thwarted my travel plans or distracted us from new projects. At times, staff members have protested that my vision was outpacing my ability to lead it or their ability to implement it. Key leaders in my congregation have moved out of town just as I was ready to entrust some part of the church into their care. I'm grateful to God for the glimpses He's given me of what work was intended to be. But daily I am aware of the maddening encroachment of thorns and thistles in the patch of the world that has been entrusted to me for this season. Accepting fruitlessness. One of the most vivid depictions of the frustration and fruitlessness of work is found in Peter Schaeffer's play, Amadeus. Antonio Salieri is court composer to the Habsburg Emperor and a highly successful writer of operas. He has power and wealth, and yet he senses the mediocrity of what he has produced. Then he meets Mozart and hears his music, and in a flash he stands revealed to himself. He realizes that in Mozart's music he is hearing the beauty he has aspired to create his entire life, but at the same moment, he knows that he will never be capable of producing it himself. As he looks at a written score of Mozart's music, he feels caged, allowed to look through the bars and perceive, but not participate in the glory he has hungered for. As he stares at the score, he thinks, "Displace one note, and there would be diminishment. Displace one phrase, and the structure would fall. Here was the very voice of God. I was staring through the cage of those meticulous ink strokes at an absolute, inimitable beauty." Salieri had to live with the existential frustration of work. That is, despite his dedication and experience, he wasn't as good at composing music as he wanted to be. Yet in terms of outcomes, he was professionally accomplished, achieved high status, and enjoyed financial success. Meanwhile, Mozart was a musical prodigy with abundant gifts, yet he suffered rejection and poverty. Both Mozart and Salieri had success in some aspects of their work lives, yet experienced deep frustration in others. It is important for us to understand and hold in tension what the Bible says about creation and about the fall, about God's plan for work, and also about the problems of work in a broken world. As products of the Depression and two world wars, my parents' and grandparents' generations were grateful to have work of any kind because it helped them and their family survive. But members of my children's generation are utterly dissimilar. They insist that work be fulfilling and fruitful, that it fully fit their talents and their dreams, and that it do something amazing for the world, as one Google executive described his company's mission. Andy Crouch observes, "We moderns certainly can't be accused of lacking self-confidence. The explosion of books about changing the world fits our self-image." While the circumstances shaping my parents' generation perhaps gave them a lower view of work than the one found in the Bible's description of creation, so my children's generation has a more naive and utopian view of work than is suggested by the Bible in its description of the world's fall into sin. In light of all this, was Salieri missing his calling? Should he have taken up work further afield from composition, in the hope that he would not have been as frustrated? I think many contemporary young adults actually might have given him that advice, and they would have been wrong. Salieri was called to contribute to the world as a concert composer. In fact, he produced music that we still have today. The same may well be true to you. Just because you cannot realize your highest aspirations in work does not mean you have chosen wrongly, or are not called to your profession, or that you should spend your life looking for the perfect career that is devoid of frustration. That would be a fruitless search for anyone. You should expect to be regularly frustrated in your work, even though you may be in exactly the right vocation. Nonetheless, was Salieri asking the right questions? Was he justified in longing for an experience of work that might afford him the deep satisfaction of greatness? Of course he was. And while such a line of thought might have seemed self-indulgent to my parents' generation, we know dozens of people for whom those questions led to a new vocation. A young woman in our church was recruited out of college to work on Wall Street. She was one of the leaders of our church's ministry to financial services professionals. Despite success and financial rewards, she made the decision several years into her job that what she really wanted to do with her life was to become a nurse. She walked away from the high salary to go to nursing school and now has begun to practice. In a world where people have on average 3 to 4 different in their work lives, it is perfectly natural that changing careers may be necessary to maximize fruitfulness. God can and often does change what He calls us to do. Deep consolation. Because of the nature of God's creation, we need work for our happiness. And because of God's intentions for our work, to contribute to the flourishing of the world, we have glimpses of what we could accomplish. But because of the fall of the human race, our work is also profoundly frustrating, never as fruitful as we want, and often a complete failure. This is why so many people inhabit the extremes of idealism and cynicism, or even ricochet back and forth between those poles. Idealism says, through my work I am going to change things, make a difference, accomplish something new, bring justice to the world. Cynicism says, nothing really changes. Don't get your hopes up. Do what it takes to make a living. Don't let yourself care too much. Get out of it whatever you can. Genesis chapter 3 verse 18 tells us not only that thorns and thistles will come out of the ground, but also that you will eat the plants of the field. Thorns and food. Work will still bear some fruit, though it will always fall short of its promise. Work will be both frustrating and fulfilling, and sometimes, just often enough, human work gives us a glimpse of the beauty and genius that might have been the routine characteristic of all our work, and what, by the grace of God, it will be again in the new heavens and new earth. Tolkien's dream and the resulting story Leif by Nigel are simply a depiction of this hope. Nigel imagined a beautiful tree that he never was able to produce and paint during his life. So he died weeping that his picture, the great work of his life, was not completed. No one would ever see it. And yet, when he got to the heavenly country, there was the tree. This was Tolkien's way of saying, to us as well as to himself, that our deepest aspirations and work will come to complete fruition in God's future. Just as Nigel's tree survived in all its glory, people will hear Salieri's music, and they will somehow taste the fruit of the project you are working on right now. There will be work in the paradise of the future, just like there was in the paradise of the past, because God Himself takes joy in His work. In that paradise, you will be useful in the lives of others to infinite degrees of joy and satisfaction. You will perform with all the skill you can imagine. Christians have, through their hope in God's story of redemption for the world He created, a deep consolation that enables them to work with all their being and never be ultimately discouraged by the frustrating present reality of this world, in which thorns grow up when they are trying to coax up other things. We accept the fact that in this world our work will always fall short, just as we sinners always fall short of the glory of God. See Romans chapter 3, verse 23. Because we know that our work in this life is not the final word. We call upon this consolation every Christmas, though we often do not realize what we are saying. No more let sin or sorrows grow, nor thorns infest the ground. He comes to make His blessings flow, far as the curse is found, far as the curse is found, far as the curse is found. Chapter 6. Work becomes pointless. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Ecclesiastes, chapter 2, verse 17. under the sun. We have seen that work in a fallen world can be fruitless. It can also be pointless. This is another aspect of the alienation human beings sense in their work. That is, while many workers are frustrated by unconsummated skills and unfulfilled aspirations, many others experience no satisfaction or fulfillment in their work even when they have realized their aspirations and become successful. One of the most poignant expressions of the way human work can feel so profoundly meaningless comes from a very ancient document, the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes. The narrator in the book of Ecclesiastes is called, in Hebrew, Kohelet, which can be translated as the teacher or perhaps even the philosopher. In order to understand what Ecclesiastes has to say about work, however, we need to take a moment to understand the literary genre of the book and how the author gets his points across. Anyone who reads through Ecclesiastes will be struck by many things that appear to contradict the rest of the Bible. While the Bible everywhere challenges people to live thoroughly wise and righteous lives, Ecclesiastes seems to warn about being too righteous or too wicked and commends a middle road, not too moral or not too immoral, not too wise or too foolish. See Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verses 15 through 17. How do we explain statements like this? Old Testament scholar Tremper Longman points out that there was a literary form at that time called fictional autobiography. In this form, the writer could introduce a fictional character, give a description of his or her life's course, and then conclude with general insights and teachings drawn from the case study of the recounted life. And indeed, in Ecclesiastes, it is possible to discern two narrators or voices. First, the writer of the prologue introduces the fictional character, Kohelet, who, in turn, speaks in the first person about all the ways he sought to find fulfillment and meaning in life under the sun. The term under the sun is crucial to understanding the perspective of the philosopher. In general, it refers to life in this world considered in and of itself, apart from any greater or eternal reality. The quest of the philosopher is to have a meaningful life based solely on what can be found within the confines of this material world, achievement, pleasure, and learning. Finally, the original writer speaks in his own voice again and does an evaluation in the epilogue. See chapter 12, verses 8 through 14. Thus, the writer can dramatize his main themes by depicting the wisest, richest, most gifted man possible, who nonetheless could not find fulfillment in this life. Some books of the Bible are like listening to a pastor giving counsel on how to live, the book of James in the New Testament, for example, or Proverbs in the Old Testament. But reading Ecclesiastes is like sitting in a philosophy class with a professor who provokes you with thorny Socratic questions and strange case studies, who pulls you into a dialogue to lead you to discover truth for yourself. The philosopher pushes you to look at the foundations of your life and to ask the basic questions that we might otherwise avoid. Is there any meaning to your life? What are you really doing it all for? Why is there so much wrong with the world? How will you cope with it? The author of Ecclesiastes is using the character of the philosopher to push readers toward an understanding of the transcendent uniqueness and necessity of God. Nothing within this world is sufficient basis for a meaningful life here. If we base our lives on work and achievement, on love and pleasure, or on knowledge and learning, our existence becomes anxious and fragile, because circumstances in life are always threatening the very foundation of our lives, and death inevitably strips us of everything we hold dear. Ecclesiastes is an argument that existential dependence on a gracious Creator God, not only abstract belief, is a precondition for an unshakable, purposeful life. Catherine Alsdorf, like many who make their way to our church well into their careers, can relate to all three of these pursuits: seeking the meaning of life through learning in college, pursuing pleasure and adventure after that, followed by an almost desperate thrust into work and career in her 30s, in a full-tilt effort to make life fulfilling. She began to accumulate accomplishments and even some financial prosperity, but grew increasingly stressed and even bitter. She describes her resentment at the time of others who were enjoying the fruits of a good life that they hadn't fully earned. Her accomplishments were never enough, and the abundant benefits were never satisfying. As she would put it, "I couldn't handle the idea that it was all meaningless, so I just put my head down and worked harder." Eventually, she started to consider the gospel of Christ because the philosophies of this world were taking her nowhere. The emptiness of life was pushing her toward her own understanding of that transcendent uniqueness of God. The meaninglessness of work. The philosopher makes his case in stages. The book begins with what has been called three life projects, each an effort to discover a meaningful life under the sun. The first is a quest to make sense of life through learning and wisdom. See Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, verses 12 through 18, and chapter 2, verses 12 through 16. The second is an effort to make life fulfilling through the pursuit of pleasure. See chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. The third project that the philosopher undertakes to chase away his sense of pointlessness is the pursuit of achievement through hard work. See Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 17 through 26. Having tried to live for learning and for pleasure, he now tries to live for the accomplishment of concrete goals and the accrual of wealth and influence. But in the end, he concludes that work cannot, all by itself, deliver a meaningful life. "So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind." Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 17. Why does he draw this conclusion? When we work, we want to make an impact. That can mean getting personal recognition for our work, or making a difference in our field, or doing something to make the world a better place. Nothing is more satisfying than a sense that through our work we have accomplished some lasting achievement. But the philosopher startles us by arguing that even if you are one of the few people who breaks through and accomplishes all you hope for, it's all for nothing. For in the end, there are no lasting achievements. "I hate all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish? Yet, they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This, too, is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun." Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 18 through 20. Whether quickly or slowly, all the results of our toil will be wiped away by history. The person who takes the business after you, or who picks up the cause or organization after you, may undo all you have done. Of course, some history makers have brought inventions or innovations that stay with the human race for a long time, but those persons are very rare, and of course, eventually, even the most famous will not be long remembered. See Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 16. Since everything and every accomplishment under the sun will be ground to dust in the end, even civilization itself. All work, even the most historic, will eventually be forgotten and its impact totally neutralized. See chapter 1, verses 3 through 11. In short, even if your work is not fruitless, it is ultimately pointless if life under the sun is all there is. The alienation of work. Work under the sun is meaningless because it does not last, and so it takes away our hope in the future. It also alienates us from God and from one another, so it takes away our joy in the present. We may again be sympathetic to Antonio Salieri within the narrative of the play Amadeus. Here is a man who aspires to create extraordinary music but instead is given modest talents. Being near Mozart shows him how ordinary his music is. He asks God to fill him with creative brilliance, but to no avail. Salieri becomes furious with God. So he says to God, "From now on, we are enemies, you and I, because you will not enter me with all my need for you, because you scorn my attempts. You are unjust, unfair, unkind." Salieri turns bitter against God and does what he can to destroy Mozart, God's instrument. Was God being unfair and unkind? If he was, he wasn't being so only to Salieri. Arguably, only a handful of musicians in all of history have been given gifts like Mozart had. No, Salieri's response was unusually dark and desperate because he had built his entire life on his dream of fame through music. He had begun by trying to put God in his debt. "Whilst my father prayed earnestly to God to protect commerce, I would offer up secretly the proudest prayer a boy could think of. Lord, make me a great composer. Let me celebrate your glory through music, and be celebrated myself. Make me famous through the world, dear God. Make me immortal. After I die, let people speak my name forever with love for what I wrote." The word immortal is the key to what is going on in Salieri's heart. His appropriate ambition had become his misplaced salvation, so his considerable success was not enough. He experienced not ordinary disappointment, but alienation and heartbreak, because he was not as good as Mozart. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labor under the sun? All their days their work is grief and pain. Even at night their minds do not rest. This, too, is meaningless. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 22 and 23. Grief and pain so great that he cannot rest. This is the experience of the person whose soul is resting wholly on the circumstances of their work. In this poignant picture, the author is consciously contrasting us with the God whose labor led to real rest. See Genesis chapter 2, verse 2. And, unconsciously with the Savior, who could even sleep through a storm. See Mark chapter 4, verse 38. Another reason that work feels so alienating is the injustice and depersonalization ever present in all social systems, and which so often infect the nature of work we do. For example, in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 8, Kohelet says, "If you see the poor oppressed in a district, and justice and rights denied, do not be surprised at such things. For one official is eyed by a higher one, and over them both are others higher still." Old Testament commentator Michael A. Eaton writes of this text that Kohelet considers the frustrations of oppressive bureaucracy with its endless delays and excuses, and justice is lost between the tiers of the hierarchy. When Kohelet wrote, only government was a large enough institution to have a bureaucracy, but the last 200 years have seen the rise of industrialization and the modern corporation. Karl Marx was the first person to speak of alienated labor in the heyday of early 19th century European industry, where thousands of workers crowded into industrial centers, working 14 hours a day at physically debilitating and mentally stultifying factory jobs. At its best, work was a grim form of self-denial for the sake of mere physical survival. Of course, for centuries, most people endured backbreaking work just to survive. Yet at least in small farms or shops, it was possible to see the product of one's work. But in a factory, a worker might be tasked to put 5 nuts onto wheel lugs every 30 seconds, hour after hour, day after day. In his book, Working, Studs Terkel interviewed many industrial workers, including Mike, who put steel parts onto a rack, lowered them into a vat of paint that bonded to their surfaces, and then raised and unloaded the rack. That was all he did. Put it on, take it off. Put it on, take it off, he reports. In between, I don't even try to think. His job is typical of manufacturing work, or even office work, which has been subdivided.